We continue with the ominous parallels. Kind of sorry for the lapse in time, but couldn't do much about it for a lot of reasons. After this, there'll be two more files, audio files, and that'll be it for the book. So we'll pick it up here. It's chapter 12. This is Peikoff's The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. I'm looking through this book. Yeah, I just think it's one of the all-time old-timers. Okay, here we go. It took over a century for the ideas of the Kantian axis to be implanted in the German mind. It took 14 years for Hitler, relying on this preparation, to rise to the position of chancellor. It took 6 months for the new chancellor to transform the country into a totalitarian state. The process of transformation consisted in establishing the nation's collectivist premise fully as the undisputed, uncontradicted law of the land. The method was to wipe out any limitation on the power of the central government. The first major step was the decree for the protection of the people and the state, promulgated in parentheses by the aged Hindenburg, end of parentheses, on February 28, 1933. This decree abrogated individual rights in Germany. This is a block quote, and I'll check out where it comes from. Restrictions on personal liberty, on the right of free expression of opinion, including freedom of the press, on the rights of assembly and association, and violations of the privacy of postal, telegraphic, and telephonic communications, and warrants for house searches, orders for confiscations, as well as restrictions on property, are also permissible beyond the legal limits otherwise prescribed. I did take a look, and that was lifted from Shire's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Back to the text. And actually, if you think about that block quote I just read, I mean, that's exactly what's taking place here. All in the name of keeping you safe and secure. A month later, the power of the Reichstag was formally annulled. The Enabling Act of March 23rd transferred to Hitler all legislative prerogatives, including the right to deviate from the Constitution at his sole discretion. We call it executive orders. This act was approved by the Republic's last freely elected Reichstag. That body committed suicide by a vote of 444-94. The Social Democrats cast the negative votes. The Communists had been barred from their seats. All the other parties voted yes. The non-Nazi parties, including the Nationalists, were then dissolved. The individual states were turned into mere administrative arms of the Reich. The courts leave to apply the new rule that, quote, the law and the will of the Führer are one, end of quote. The officer corps, still a powerful force in Germany, approved Hitler's policy of rearmament and voiced no opposition to the process of Nazification. If anyone did voice opposition, he found two new institutions to deal with, both copied from Soviet Russia, the Gestapo and the concentration camps. Special government bodies were created to control, according to the requirements of the public interest, every aspect of literature, music, the fine arts, the theater, the movies, radio, and the press. Hundreds of tons of books were destroyed. The Marxists and the cultural modernists, and several other groups, had done their job. Hitler had no further need for anarchy and subversion of the system. The churches were not regarded as subversive. Though harassed and intimidated, they were allowed to function. The country's young people were sent to educational institutions from kindergarten to university, which had been completely Aryanized. The youngsters joined the Hitler Youth at the age of six. The children declared that they would never speak of I, but only of we. Through the agency of three new guilds, the Food Estate, the Estate of Trade and Industry, and the Labor Front, the government assumed the control of every group of producers and consumers in the country. In accordance with the method of German socialism, the facade of a market economy was retained. All prices, wages, and interest rates, however, were fixed by the central authority. They were prices, wages, and interest rates in appearance only. In reality, they were merely determinations of quantity relations in the government's orders. This is socialism in the outward guise of capitalism. The nation's businessmen retained the responsibility to produce and suffered the losses attendant on failure. The state determined the purpose and conditions of their production and reaped the benefits directly or indirectly. It expropriated all profits. The time has passed, explained the Nazi Minister of Economics, when the notion of economic self-seeking and unrestricted use of profits made can be allowed to dominate, the economic system must serve the nation. What a dummkopf I was, cried Steel Baron Fritz Thiessen, an early Nazi supporter who fled the country. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard that name before, Thiessen or Thiessen. By ordering a vast series of public works, then a massive rearmament program accompanied by military conscription, the Nazis ended unemployment. Nor did the Germans have to worry about job security any longer. Men were drafted into labor service by the government and attached to their jobs like medieval serfs. And the reason I'm bringing that up, too, is that because that is something that was mentioned in Trotsky's Terror and Communism, or Terrorism and Communism. That this whole idea of universal I can't remember the exact language in Trotsky's book. I think it was Universal Military Workers Act or something. It is something very strange and very eerily akin to the legislation, and I believe it's still floating around on the Hill, that comes from that original, I believe, 2003 Universal Military Service Act. And then they changed the name. They've adjusted it twice. And it is now under Universal National Service Act. But with the Trotsky situation and what he wrote, and I don't know if it predates what we're reading here, it really doesn't matter. It's pretty close in time anyway. But here also you hear the Germans creating these programs that are a it said that a massive rearmament program accompanied by military conscription. Men were drafted into labor service. So you see how there's this mixing of working and military, and the idea of the Universal National Service Act, I think it's now of what, 2007? They've last adjusted it. And there might even be another one. I keep it around. It never goes away. But there is that same situation that we saw here in Germany and that Trotsky spoke of in Russia. And that was something that I thought would probably be advanced during the Obama administration. It will be if he returns, and you can all laugh at that, and I would too in a sense because of the way this whole thing is going. But remember, we can be manipulated, and in a matter of weeks, he could be, you know, the greatest thing since the second coming of FDR, and it could happen then. Or maybe it'll happen under Republican, I don't know. It was just that we last saw something like that under Roosevelt in the new screw job called the New Deal. So here it pops up again. The serfs were carefully tended. The state insisted on the beautification of factories, recreational space for the workers, gardens on the factory grounds, better lighting and ventilation, and much more. The workers' leisure time was taken over. A comprehensive program of governmental lecture courses, art shows, vacation trips, and the like, in parentheses, the Strength Through Joy program, ensured that, even away from their jobs, men never stopped hearing about the need to work and the sacrifice for the community. As to Hitler's pledges to the poorer groups, the Republic's social service budgets were greatly increased, and a variety of welfare funds, programs, agencies, and policies were introduced or expanded, including special provisions for such items as unemployment relief, workmen's compensation, health insurance, pensions, winter help campaigns for the destitute, the Reich Mother's Service for indigent mothers and children, and the National Socialist People's Welfare Program. In regard to fundamentals, Hitler kept his promises to the German people. Everyone in every class, field, and income bracket was manacled to the state. The state meant the party. Quote from Hitler to Rosning. The party takes over the function of what has been society. That is what I wanted them to understand. And now we have another block quote. The party is all-embracing. It rules over lives in all their breadth and depth. We must therefore develop branches of the party in which the whole of individual life will be reflected. Each activity and each need of the individual will thereby be regulated by the party as the representative of the general good. There will be no license, no free space in which the individual belongs to himself. This is socialism, not such trifles as the private possession of the means of production. Of what importance is that if I range men firmly within a discipline they cannot escape? Let them then own land or factories as much as they please. The decisive factor is that the state, through the party, is supreme over them, regardless whether they are owners or workers. All that, you see, is unessential. Our socialism goes far deeper. The people about us are unaware of what is really happening to them. They gaze fascinated at one or two familiar superficialities, such as possessions and income and rank and other outworn conceptions. As long as these are kept intact, they are quite satisfied. But in the meantime, they have entered a new relation. A powerful social force has caught them up. They themselves are changed. What are ownership and income to that? Why need we trouble to socialize banks and factories? We socialize human beings. And that is from the Voice of Destruction, previously quoted, I believe, in here. I'm not going to take the time right now to find out who's the author of that. If you've gone through these files in a more recent time, front to back, that might be familiar to you. Otherwise, I mean, I have to refresh my own memory if it ever retained that at all. All right, moving on. Living standards drop for every major economic group and class. The government continuously seized more of the country's earnings. There was abundance only for the military. Guns will make us powerful. Butter will only make us fat, said Goring. The Germans had believed that Nazism was a practical solution to the Depression. Even before the war, they began to find out otherwise. After 1939, they learned still more. But disaster as such does not change a country's mind or its ideas. No matter how they were exploited or what hardships they suffered, the Germans accepted Hitler's rule. The Nazi reign of terror is merely one part of the reason. The policies and statements of every group still able to speak in the 30s reveal the other part. The respectable German right rallied behind the swastika from the beginning. The Protestant clergy explained that it saw in the new government the chance for a moral renaissance, which would nourish religious feeling, obedience to authority, and the spirit of sacrifice. The centrists protested when the Nazis interfered with Catholic activities or interests, but conceded Hitler's, quote, achievements, including, in one bishop's summary, the, quote, defeat of communism, the introduction of the Führer principle, the enforcement of moral power, and the banning of streetwalkers, end of quotation marks. On June 10, 1933, the Catholic prelates issued a lengthy pastoral. They recognized, they said, quote, that the individual is part of a larger organism and must work not simply for himself but for the common good. Furthermore, just because authority plays such a prominent role in Catholic affairs, they can well understand the emphasis now placed upon it in relation to the state. A quote, the prelates added a reservation. The government, they said, should, quote, inside a quote, not curtail human freedom more than the general welfare warrants. Moving on with this quote, that many Germans of intellectual as well as of more simple mentality could at the very same time worship the God on the cross and idolize the Führer is one of those irrational aberrations of the human spirit that can merely be described but not intelligently explained, writes Pinson. Perhaps the fact is not quite so baffling as he suggests. And I'll just stop there too. And I mean, again, you see it here with the misguided and ascriptural belief in these supposed evangelical Christians. The other ones, you know, who cares? These are actually people who say they read the Bible, and how they can go ahead and be ready to back bloodshed in the name of advancing anything, whether it's the kingdom of God or whether it's to protect supposedly the U.S. empire. It's crazy, but here you see it happened. And it was also very obvious in Germany prior to World War II. Back to the text, the country's secular moderates, such as the one-time Democrats, spoke their mind also. The reaction to Hitler is epitomized by a remark of Hjalmar Schacht, a founder of the Democratic Party who became a Nazi minister of economics. This man, said Dr. Schacht in 1935, set about first to raise the moral standard of the nation. That is why I think him a great man. He has raised the moral standard of the people. End of quote. The German left was not free to speak publicly. Many communists, in particular, disappeared in Nazi jails or escaped abroad. The Marxists who survived, however, did not challenge Hitler's basic viewpoint. The absolute state is right, they said in effect, but we could have run it better. This kind of objection posed no threat to the Nazi rule, nor did it prevent another disciple of Marx from recognizing a community of values with Hitler and acting accordingly. In August 1939, the statesmen of the West, who had long derogated abstract principles, were struck dumb by the signing of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. As to the men who ultimately shaped the ideas of the country's political groups, that is, the intellectuals, the overwhelming majority forgot their scruples against, quote, rowdiness. Illustrious Nobel Prize-winning names eagerly backed the Nazi cause and flocked to embrace the brutes. Professor Eugene Lufkin, an authority in philosophy and law at Bonn, named the belief at the root of the embrace in a statement praising and justifying the book burning. Quote, the voice of blood, he said, speaks a louder language than that of the intellect. And ain't that the truth? Moving on, the remnants of the Weimar leadership in every field and almost without exception rushed to agree with the principles of the Nazis. The rush was often opportunism or appeasement, but the agreement was real. The state which Hitler established did in fact embody the fundamental ideas of Germany's political cultural tradition. Many Germans still did not like Hitler's personality or associates or tactics. They swallowed their reaction down. They could not challenge the essence and climax of their own long-cherished basic principles. Did an action of their new rulers make no sense to the Germans? They reminded themselves that reason is nothing and that feeling, or authority, is all. Did men never have a moment to breathe free of a noisy, howling, swastika-waving mob? They reminded themselves that the individual is nothing and that the Volk is all. Was every group terrorized, enslaved, and ruthlessly milked dry? The Germans were willing to endure these conditions. Quote, and this is from Hannah Arendt. Selflessness in the sense that oneself does not matter, the feeling of being expendable, was no longer the expression of individual idealism, but a mass phenomenon. The Germans remembered their age-old vision of national greatness defined by discipline, obedience, and self-abnegation. They remembered Kant's idea that, quote, the principle of one's own happiness is the most objectionable of all, end of quote. And that self-love is, quote, the very source of evil, end of quote. They grasped that now they had their historic chance, the chance to suppress the, quote, evil, and to make the vision a reality, and they seized the chance, and they acted on it. At last, the Germans were practicing in full the philosophy they had been taught. And that's the end of chapter 12, and of this segment, we'll have two more, and then I'll bring us to a close in Leonard Peikoff's book, The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America.